want to start with a few thank yous, of course, to Carlos Mota and the staff of the new museum. It's really wonderful to have opportunities like this to come down and have an audience and be able to display the kind of work that we're doing. So a big thank you to those folks for the start. I'm going to tell you a little bit about my proposal for this evening, and then we'll take it from there just so everyone knows what they're in for. You can figure out if you want to get yourself closer to the door or stay right where you are in the middle. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about myself, and then my bigger proposed agenda is to talk a little bit about the Against Equality Collective, sort of like who we are, how we started, a little bit of our history, talk about an overview of our projects that we've done to date. And then I'll talk specifically about the Don't Ask, Don't Tell book that we just published, as well as the journal that I edited that Carlos had started. And then after that, we can sort of jump into a more conversational Q&A type thing if folks are into that. And we'll try to keep it around an hour so people don't get... I just hate feeling like I'm keeping people captive. If people want to keep talking, we can do that, but we'll try to keep it to an hour. So with that, like Carlos said, I'm a gay, queer, faggot, whatever you want to call it, from Central Maine. I recently moved up to Montreal to do school stuff, but Central Maine is really where I've been for the last almost 12 years. I live in a working class middle town that is about 25,000 people, so not tiny, but not a city by New York standards. So that's sort of the place I'm coming out of in terms of my work. And I'm doing both performance work, visual work, as well as the sort of textual work that is happening with Against Equality that I'll talk a lot more about tonight. And so, for folks that don't know, in 2009, the gay marriage referendum happened in Maine, where the legislators had passed gay marriage, the governor had signed it into law, and then it was overturned by the People's Veto, where essentially the religious right got out enough people to collect signatures to have a vote on the law, and then it was overturned. So this was all happening in 2009, and the campaign that was run in Maine was really problematic. It was mostly run by upper class, upper middle class, white liberals from the southern end of the state, where all the money is. And the rest of the state was essentially abandoned by this campaign, and homophobic religious right was able to, on a grand scale, able to talk a bunch of shit about us queers, and there was no one to pick up the pieces that weren't the southern rich part of the state where all the resources already existed. So I was pretty upset about this. I was really frustrated. I was working at a LGBT youth drop-in center at the time and just watching kids come in feeling really totally decimated by this process. And there was no one there to sort of pick up the pieces except for this one organization that I worked with, and we were only in one town, and we work on a $12,000 a year budget. So it was really frustrating, made me really angry. So I started this website called Against Equality, and I started writing about this marriage campaign. So the group kind of actually started as me just being an angry queer in the middle of nowhere in Maine, and I started a website. But the writing I was doing was actually resonating with a lot of other people, and people were sending me emails after I wrote this pretty long piece about how the funding structure worked in Maine and where all this money came from and where it went. And so other people started sending me their writing and their projects, and I began assembling it as an archive as opposed to this like personal blog where I was just being some angry faggot like writing on the internet, which I'm sure maybe folks in here have done that as well. So yeah, the project moved from this like really personal, like kind of angry, not sure how to deal with what was happening at the moment, to a much larger project where people were connecting the issues of not just gay marriage, but were connecting it to gays in the military, as well as the gay and lesbian movement's demand for hate crimes legislation, which sort of folds gay and lesbian politics into the prison industrial complex. So what began as just about marriage, like kind of flourished and became about sort of a broader politics of inclusion, where gay and lesbian people are demanding inclusion within sort of cultural traditions, systems, and institutions that maybe aren't the best place to put our time, energy, and money. And so the archive has grown. Now it has over almost 200 entries of people doing textual work, as well as visual and cultural work. But as we started archiving visual and cultural work, we also noticed that there isn't a lot out there around these sort of themes in the archive around marriage, military, and prisons. So some of the projects that we've done have been trying to like encourage and incubate people's projects that are focusing on sort of these themes of the archive. So we've done a call for art project, a postcard project, and I can show you pieces from. And we'll be doing a poster project in the future. But just trying to find ways to activate the archive in terms of like producing more visual culture around the themes and politics that we think are really important, because we sort of see a lack. And this exhibition itself is sort of one of those ways to address that lack. So Carlos's work is also in the archive as well. So that's how the project grew. It started as just me. Right now there's currently 5 people working in the collective. It's me in Montreal, and 2 folks in DC, someone in Chicago, and someone in Madison, Wisconsin. And since two of those folks are sort of central to the collective, and I have a bit of an audio piece from them that I'll play in just a little bit about the Don't Ask, Don't Tell book. But yeah, so there's lots of different people in all of this, not just me. But it did start out that way. So I'm gonna just pull out a handful of the other projects just to show you guys what they are, and then we'll start talking about Don't Ask, Don't Tell. So our logo is sort of a play off of the Human Rights Campaign. For folks that know, it's like the blue square with yellow equal sign. And we came up with the blue square with the yellow greater than sign, sort of to poke fun at the HRC and the giant money pit that they are and their pretty shady politics, but to also just have this like fun sort of culture jammy way to sort of draw attention to the work that we're doing and make fun of the HRC at the same time. And those are, if folks want them, there's a bunch of them for free on the back table. And then I was saying that there was a call for a postcard project that we did, and we have 2 series of postcards from that. This is my favorite one. It's like a little guy dancing in sequin undies while people are running off to war in the background. And then we had a second set that was done that included, we did a book launch in Melbourne, Australia in February, and so for folks that don't know, Australia is having a very similar moment to the United States where people are pushing really hard for marriage. So we also got some contributions from Australia, which has created some unique networks, and there's interesting things coming out of Australia right now where folks are organizing around a gay marriage installation. So those 2 things happened. And I didn't bring copies of the book up here, but there's the book's copies are in the back for sale, but there's also, I know, 1 or 2 floating around on the other tables. And maybe I'll take a moment to talk about why we publish, because publishing is sort of a dying thing right now in a lot of ways. And also, all the texts that are in our books are available for free online, so you don't actually have to buy a book. And so some of the things that we were thinking about in terms of actually producing books is there's a question of access, making sure that queer and trans people that are incarcerated actually have access to the conversations that are happening really readily online. So all the publications that we have are provided at no cost to prisoners. If they write us and we put announcements out in a couple of the bigger queer trans newsletters that go into the prison system. And the other thing about access is people that don't have access to high-speed internet. And maybe it might come as a surprise to urban folks, but most of the small towns north and west of me don't have high-speed internet access because the fiber optic cables don't exist, because it's actually not profitable to Verizon and Fairpoint to actually put them in. So they don't exist. So a lot of people are actually using dial-up in the Western Mountains from where I am. So the question was like, okay, like those people don't hang out on the internet in the same way that maybe folks in suburban and rural places do. So making sure that those folks have access to those same conversations that are happening online, as well as like older folks that maybe just aren't interested or aren't engaged in the same way that other folks are on the internet. And then the other question is around sort of seizing the means of productions of knowledge production. There's a lot of work that's being done on the internet that isn't taken as seriously or isn't considered real knowledge. But then once you publish it and it's in a book, all of a sudden it's like real knowledge and people can cite it in their research papers and like women's gender studies classes. And so that's sort of actually what's happened, and our books have been taken up as teaching texts, which is really interesting because people wouldn't be teaching these things even though they were already published online in the same way that, you know, now there's this like, there's a bookness to a book that makes it like official knowledge. So for us, it's about sort of seizing the means of production of knowledge. knowledge production, which I think is a really useful thing to do. And now with like on-demand printing and other ways of going about it, you don't actually have to wait for like Duke University Press to pick your book up or your manuscript. You can actually like go about it doing your own thing. And that's what we did. We applied for as many credit cards as we could. And because this is America, you can get a bunch. And that's how we printed all the books. So you should buy one later so we can pay off that debt. But yeah, like there's ways around it. There's DIY ways to do it. You don't actually have to wait for someone else to make something possible. You can actually just like try to scan your way there. And that's what we did, and it works. And so maybe I'll stop talking about that stuff and start talking about the actual book. And maybe one other thing I'll preface before actually going into the contents of the books. I toured with the first book about gay marriage, and we've sold over 2,000 copies, and people really love it. The Don't Ask, Don't Tell book, we've had a really hard time touring with it, and not a lot of us sold, which I think it's actually like a more important book in this funny way, but it's much less sexy to talk about. Like, gay marriage is this kind of like hip thing to critique right now, where it's like, don't ask, don't tell, it's like, whatever, that happened, it's gone, like, why are we still talking about this? And I actually think its legacy is a really important thing to talk about, and sort of the effects that are happening. For example, New York City Pride has a big notice on their website for active military personnel to come to the march tomorrow. Or on Sunday, Saturday, it never happens. Or San Diego Pride, whose theme this year is American Pride. Or, for example, the Dyke March in Portland, Maine. And the Dyke March is historically and traditionally much more radical than the Gay Pride March in its non-corporate nature. There was numerous cheers about how great it was that we overturned Don't Ask, Don't Tell, which is kind of terrifying in the way that this recent film that just came out that actually highlights the sexual violence against women in the U.S. military, particularly gender nonconforming women and dykes. So the fact that people were cheering about how they could now join the army, like a dyke march, was really terrifying to me. And I was like, I don't understand what's going on. Why aren't we having this conversation? So that's why this book exists, is to try to open up space and make more room for that kind of conversation. So what I'll do is I'll just give you a brief overview of the different contributions to the book, and then I'll go over a brief overview of the contributions to the journal, since they sort of play off each other, and then we can sort of open it up more broadly for questions and stuff. And we can talk about the marriage stuff too. I know it doesn't, like I said, it was like too big to talk about, but I want to talk about the Don't Ask, Don't Tell stuff, because I think it's really important. So for some folks I know, Matilda, who also has a book floating around here somewhere, Matilda wrote the introduction to the book, and she makes a really important contribution in sort of showing how AIDS activism and anti-war activism was almost synonymous in her time growing up, and sort of thinking about ACT UP's actions here in New York, where one of the rallying cries was money for AIDS, not for war. But now we're not sort of saying that anymore. Like, she's asking sort of where did that get lost, and how did we sort of develop this new gay patriot as sort of this imaginative figure. And then Kenyon Farrow, who's also a New York native, has a contribution in the book on behalf of Queers for Economic Justice, sort of pointing out that the U.S. military is not a de facto jobs program, as it's often pitched to poor people, particularly in urban settings and rural folks, so that the military is often positioned as, oh, this is the way you can get a stable job, you can get money for school, you can get out of your small town, you can get out of the ghetto, this is how you can do it, you can join the military. Then Cecilia has a piece in the book that looks at the costs, and basically she asks the question is, what does it mean to give up civil rights for the sake of human rights? So she's sort of asking, like, why don't we just ban more people from the military so that the military can't exist as it does? So what if we gave up our civil rights here so that we could protect human rights on a sort of global scale? Which is an interesting question, I think, to sort of ask. Largely rhetorical, but she recommends banning left-handed people, redheads, people with blue eyes, etc. Then Yasmin Nair, who has a piece in the book, who's a collective member based out of Chicago. She's looking at the sort of the progressive left's large abandonment of their politics when it comes to Don't Ask, Don't Tell, where they sort of only address the issue of discrimination but don't actually address the issue of militarization. Particularly Amy Goodman from Democracy Now! Often hosted Dan Choi on the show a number of times without actually critically engaging about how he's like actually promoting war and imperialism and how that's actually not okay on an anti-war radio show. So Yasmin Nair looks at that critically about how the left has largely like not actually dealt with the politics of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and how it's more complicated than like discrimination is bad, gays are good. Then Erica Miners and Trey Sullivan are looking at the militarization of our public schools, particularly this notion of discipline and often how discipline is racialized. So thinking about how inner city kids are often being tracked into more militarized school districts, particularly she's based in Chicago, where the school district is the most segregated and the most militarized, and how discipline is often like, oh, these inner city kids, these people, these youth of color, they need discipline, this is the only way to do it. And then trying to rethink that, like, instead of discipline through, like, army-like activities, like, what about the discipline that it takes to participate and produce art and culture? It's still a form of discipline, but it gets racialized in a different way. Then Tamara Knopper, her piece in the book looks at the Dream Act, and the Dream Act, for folks that don't know, was proposed by some folks in Congress as a way for children, undocumented children who came here early from their parents, sort of like didn't have a choice, they ended up here. There was a pathway for them for citizenship, and the choice was either you can gain citizenship through going to university or you gain citizenship through military service. And since there was no financial aid included, the reality is most immigrant youth were going to be tracked into the military. So she's writing critically about how she can't support the Dream Act because it's actually the only way that it provides a pathway is through military service, and it's not okay for immigrants to be treated as cannon fodder. Larry Goldsmith has a piece, again, about the poverty draft. Rural white poverty, people, their only way out is through military service, and particularly looking at abuse in the military, gender non-conforming people and people joining because of their gender non-conforming status in their rural town is like, okay, this is their way out, and they join an equally as violent institution. Then Jamal Rashid has a piece looking at the history of anti-assimilationist, anti-imperialist work, like groups like the Gay Liberation Front, sort of like looking back to the historical roots of like radical queer activism and thinking like, how did we get here? We were now demanding to be in the military, but before like anti-war platforms were central to queer politics. And then finally, Bill Andriette has a piece in the book, sort of looking at gay rights and sexual politics between the West and the East, and thinking through the possibility of sort of gay rights being a precursor to declaring war or justifying war in places where gays don't have rights. Maybe I'll talk more about that when I talk about the journal, because there's another piece in there. So those different pieces make up the context of the book. So as you can see, like pieces are coming from a lot of different directions, trying to open up the conversation in a lot of different ways, from talking about like sexual violence to questions of citizenship and national belonging. So there's a lot of different ways to like think through this question of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and how its sort of disappearance has normalized a lot of these questions about state violence and sexual violence in our culture. And then the journal that I worked on as well sort of like picks up on some of these themes, and I tried to cover a few more bases that we weren't able to cover with the book because of the limitation of space. So I'll quickly just go through a few of the pieces in there, and I'll stop talking. So in the journal, we reprinted Matilda's introduction to the Against Equality book because it's a good opening piece and introduction, as well as Tamara Knopper's piece on the Dream Act. The other pieces that are included in the journal is a reprint of a counter-recruitment packet that was put together in the early 90s by Le Gay, which is Lesbians and Gays Against Intervention, which was a group formed in the early 90s on the West Coast in the Bay Area. And their piece again looks at the sort of the US budget and looking at how much money is spent on war abroad and then looking at how much money is spent on the war at home. So thinking about what social services are cut or not being given to the adequate degree that is because we don't have money to do it because everything's being spent on war in the first Gulf War. And also if you log on and you're able on an online journal, there's a PDF link to the actual whole counter-recruitment packet, and it's pretty early, it's very early 90s, but it's super cool. I was really excited to get my hands on it. And then we have another piece in the book from an activist who was actually one of the people that was arrested with Dan Choi, chaining themselves to the fence, if folks remember that, where they were doing the Don't Ask, Don't Tell protest. This guy Ian was actually talking about how he was wrong. He humbly admits that he was wrong doing that, and sort of had his awakening through the Occupy movement in Seattle, and came to recognize that all he was doing was providing more bodies for the U.S. war machine, and thinking through like what his actions were, who benefited from his actions, and I think it's a really interesting piece. And then in closing that that journal, Carmen Chavez, who's also now a full-on collective member at Against Equality, was writing just after Hillary Clinton made her speech about how gay rights are human rights. And she sort of is again thinking through critically how this might be deployed by the Department of Defense and the State Department as a justification for intervention. Also thinking through how women's rights have also been used in the discourse about invading any Muslim country in the Middle East. So thinking through, okay, like, how do we not get situated in a way that queer politics can be leveraged in a way that justifies intervention, which kills people in other countries. And she also, again, looks at the question of the Dream Act and the idea that the only way to participate in terms of national belonging is through state violence and participating in the US military. So that's the journal in the book. They cover a lot of similar material. But I think they both do a bit of a different thing, and the journal is also very visual and has lots of images included with it as well. So if folks have questions about those projects, you can fire away and maybe answer some, and I might bounce stuff back to the audience as well.
I think it's pretty courageous like to articulate an opinion that's different from a lot of mainstream opinions. So I think that what you're doing is very admirable. I wonder, however, if many of your arguments fall into very easy dichotomies. For example, why is equality the same thing as sameness? Why is inclusion confused with assimilationism? Is a desire for inclusion so bad? I mean, does supporting the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell means that we're pro-war? That's like saying that being pro-choice is the same thing as being pro-abortion, right? Supporting people's self-choice participation, regardless of whether or not we support the war, I think is different. I think that nuance needs to be addressed because it's like none of us felt comfortable signing up for selective service, right? Those of us who are pacifists. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't support the repeal of some anti-Semitism.
Yeah, I think you're bringing up an interesting argument that a lot of people bring to the table that's a question of choice. And I would caution the argument of choice because a lot of times choice isn't actually choice. Again, thinking about the things like the Dream Act, when there was a choice between going to university or participating in the military in order to get citizenship, and the fact that there was no financial aid attached to that bill, like there's like this false perception of choice. That I would be careful to position choice as a reason why we should give people the choice when the choice that's provided is not actually a choice. And the same thing, I mean, goes for marriage, for example. You know, like, well, if people want to get married, they should be able to get married. It should be their choice. But the question isn't actually about this desire to participate. The question is about material effects in the body and material benefits, right? Like, people don't choose not to have health care. right? Like, if you have to choose to get married for immigration status, citizenship status, or whether you live or die based on whether or not you have health care, that's not a choice. So I think we need to be careful how we position choice in these sort of conversations.
I think that you're setting up a straw man. I don't think that it's, choice is something that's very easy to attack, right? Because all choices are constrained. As soon as you participate in society, choice is constrained. But I think that a more nuanced form of inclusion is what you're really fighting for in a way.
I would say that we're fighting for broad-based social and economic justice. Yeah. And we just avoid the rhetoric of equality because, the rhetoric of equality is the straw man. It doesn't actually mean anything.
What I wanted to for you to talk about is this idea of supporting the war and the kind of displacement of the rhetoric of anti-war activism and how perhaps there's this kind of pinkwashing, which is a term commonly used in the Israeli context, to present a notion of queer inclusion as a way of justifying certain kind of imperial behavior. You just mentioned that, and I'm just curious for you to speak about what it means to have an anti-war position today from a queer perspective in relationship to inclusion in the military.
Yeah, and I would like it. I would also compare that similarly to folks that are involved in the gay marriage movement, but also support universal health care, right? So there's these people that are like, yes, I support gay people having access to marriage, but I don't think it should be about health care. Everyone should have health care, right? Like, so I think a similar argument can be made in terms of being anti-war and still wanting to repeal the mass don't tell because it's discrimination, right? And I feel like that conversation happens a lot. And what we're trying to ask for is like a more nuanced, I don't know if I'm saying it from the microphone properly. I think we're asking for a more nuanced approach and sort of actually suggesting that I don't know if you can be anti-war and support putting more people in the US military. I don't think that is possible. And maybe other people feel differently. I'm sure other people feel differently, but my approach would be ban as many people as possible from the US military.
Thank you. I have two questions. This is brief, and I'm wondering if the collective is planning a third book on hate crime legislation.
It's out in October.
Oh, really? Okay. Wait, let's talk about that.
Sure.
And then the second question being, I was wondering how the collective situates itself in relation to sort of radical queer politics, because it seems to me you're quite actively remembering and recalling Gay Liberation Front, ACT UP, Queer Nation, and whatnot. And so I was wondering if you wanted to talk more about how you're situating yourself in relation to that broader history.
Yeah, sure. So first I'll just mention again that we're working on a third anthology that's focused on hate crimes legislation and the prison industrial complex, and sort of looking at that as another site of inclusion where mainstream gay and lesbian organizations are demanding inclusion within the structures that exist to punish people for acting out violently or causing harm to queer, trans, and gender non-conforming bodies. And we're sort of saying, maybe prisons isn't the right way to go in terms of actually addressing this issue of harm, and that if we want to actually address the harm in our community, it's actually a much more complicated process. Not to mention the prison industrial complex as it exists disproportionately affects queer, trans, gender non-conforming people, particularly people that are also poor, at risk of homelessness, homeless, or people of color, intravenous drug users, etc. So the prison industrial complex is like fucked up in all these ways. Like, why are we like demanding that that's the way we're going to fix our situation? And that book, the introduction is going to be done by Dean Spade, whose book is also floating around here. So that's actually coming out in October, and I've been working on it all week, so it's funny that you ask. And the second thing was how we position ourselves. I think I'm actually going to play the audio, because I think some of it actually addresses that question. But maybe the one thing I'll say is, I'm really cautious of the way radical queer both aesthetics and identity are performed, particularly in a lot of urban contexts where you gain cultural capital from being more radical. Because like, I'm from a small town, it's not cool to be queer, let alone, like, radical queer, like, people just think you're crazy. But I think it's really important to situate our work in, like, activism, as opposed to, like, this aestheticized, performative, radical queer, blah, 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 that, like, is actually really repulsive to me. So I'll play that audio, but I just wanted to, like, put that out there that, yes, we have radical queer politics, but I also don't want to get caught up in that, like, sort of performative queer politics that like polices boundaries and language and what people wear or what they listen to. But I'm going to put it on you.
All right. So this is a little conversation between myself, Karma Chavez, and also Yasmin Nair, and we're members of the Against Equality Collective. And I am, I guess, the newest member of the collective, and I'm also a assistant professor of communication at the University of Wisconsin. I'm founder of the Queer Migration Research Network, and I work on immigration issues, queer and LGBT issues, coalition building, and things like that. So that's who I am, and I'm going to turn it over to Yasmin to introduce herself.
So I'm Yasmin Nair, and I live in Chicago. And I am co-founder of the Against Equality Network with Ryan. The AE Collective, as everyone knows, started sometime in November 2009 when Ryan had the idea of starting an archive. And then we began collecting material for the archive sometime in 2009 to 2010. I write, that's what I do in Chicago. And I guess that's it for now. I can.
That's good. So then what we wanted to do is we wanted to just say a couple of words as part of this event to explain how it was that we came to our anti-war, anti-imperialist sort of positions, and also what we think is the importance of the Against Equality perspective on these things in terms of queer politics. So I'm going to turn it over to Yasmin to have her say just a few minutes about what she thinks about these things, and then I'll do the same. So, Yas?
Yes. I think the biggest reason why we decided to first begin an archive and then actually begin doing a lot of collective organizing around Against Equality's project is our sense of disappointment, certainly my sense of disappointment with where the LGBT movement was going. It was not just that I was disappointed with the mainstream LGBT movement, which I think is pathetic and sad, but also with the so-called progressive wing of the LGBT movement. I think that over the last few decades, the left has been dying a slow, anguished death in the United States, and the LGBT queer radical movement has been sputtering to a halt as well. And what I saw within the LGBTQ queer radical movement was increasingly a sense of failure and a sense of futility and a sense that the only way to make any kinds of gains was to constantly seek conciliation and to seek recourse in the very very damaging institutions which all of us had originally been very resistant to, institutions like, and I do think the family is an institution, the family, the state, policing, right, the enforcement of policing strategies as some way to gain quote-unquote justice, for instance, the idea that the family, the sort of, even if it's a non-heteronormative family, but the idea, the very idea that somehow the family is any way to gain support and nurturing, for instance, for queer people, be seeking for alternatives within the policing regime. I was severely disappointed with all of that, the turn towards hate crimes legislation, the turn towards marriage. And for I think there's a large number of queer radical people out there who are still seeking a truly radical vision of a world. And I think the word radical itself has become sullied because we have, because I think there's a large segment of LGBTQ progressives, for instance, who actually want to distance themselves from what that means because of its supposed associations with violence and so on. And I think there has been a failure to reclaim a legacy of revolution, a legacy of revolution which sometimes includes a dissent and sometimes includes violent means by which to secure that dissent. And I think against equality affords many of us a conceptual and physical and material space to really gather our thoughts together, but also to keep in mind our radical history that I think a great many of us are in the process of forgetting. And that's why this collective and my fellow cohorts in the collective, but also the larger community this collective has come to stand in for, is so important for me.
Yeah, I would, I mean, I think that's great. I would totally agree with that. I would say, you know, for me personally, I've always very much been frustrated with the mainstream movement and, you know, the left generally. And on this particular issue of imperialism and war, I think it's, you know, it, now more than ever, it's necessary in the, as DADT no longer exists and everyone celebrates that. I think the against equality ongoing critique of imperialism and of why we shouldn't be celebrating the fact that now, you know, gays can kill just like everybody else, I think is absolutely crucial. And, you know, Conrad's continued work to push this issue, even when it's not popular to push it anymore, and all of us in the collective, I think it's absolutely necessary. So I hope that we continue and continue to come up with new ways to offer queer critiques of imperialism, of war generally, and militarization, the militarization of everyday life, these kinds of things. I think it's a very important thing that, that we're doing. Yes, did you have closing things you wanted to say?
Yes, I think I want to address two things that keep coming up with Against Equality. One of them is the idea that somehow critique is invalid or illegitimate as a way of changing the world. And I would want to say that revolutions depend upon critique. Revolutions depend upon people actually getting together and articulating dissent in one form or the other. So I would really caution those of us who scoff at the idea of an archive providing anything that would actually change the world to remember that most revolutions came about because of people getting together and actually exchanging ideas. So I do want to, I would like people to remember the importance of dissent and analytic critique in the act of revolution. That's one thing that I would really want to focus on. I think the other issue for me has been that we need to remember that a collective like Against Equality does represent, you know, we are not disembodied people who only exist on the internet. I think that's also been something that that seems to be a perception out there. But we are real material bodies working on this project in and engaging this work within our daily lives, right? So we're all, whether we're academics or activists or all these strange combinations. I mean, I call myself an academic activist commentator, and sometimes I have no idea what the hell that means, except that I'm struggling to make a living constantly. But I think it's important to remember that, you know, collective energy, especially in this day and age of the internet, I think collective energy can be dissipated, but can also be no less effective. And it's also important to remember that those of us who might feel geographically separate, right, can still forge amazing radical collective movements as long as we remember that the object is not to simply stay on the internet and take down people in Facebook conversations, but the object is to create a groundswell of thought and a radical revolutionary energy around that and to take it back into our lives. And I think that's what all five of us, and there are really only five of us in the collective, that's what all five of us have committed to. And I'm really proud of the fact that our work, right, conceptually, theoretically, materially, gives people so much energy to take that critique and to start to transform the agendas of the institutions that they work in.
Yeah, I think I would agree with all of that. And I think that's a good place for us to turn it back over to Conrad. Hope you enjoy the book.
So Yasmin has this tendency to talk for a really long time. So that only 8 minutes was really hard to pull off. But the sort of one big piece I want to take away from that again is that, back to your question about like situating ourselves and like revolutionary potential, is that a lot of us that engage in the collective are also involved in community groups back home, and sort of the archive came out of a necessity to sort of cobble together some theoretical frameworks and groundwork to sort of help us think through what we're doing in our everyday lives. So we're not just like these random academics that like shit talk people on the internet, but like we actually are all doing activism around public education, around LGBT youth in rural places, militarization of schools. Like all of us come from this from actually doing real everyday work. And that, again, it isn't about this like radical queer aesthetic and identity. We actually believe our lives depend on the work that we're doing.
I had a question about the collective's like larger positive views and specifically how they're gay related. So I get the idea that the collective is anti-war and maybe anti-marriage equality, but what, with the exception of anti-marriage equality, with something like fighting for social economic justice, what is specifically gay about that? I mean, that's right, so like poverty, that can affect anyone. Now, it actually affects certain groups more than others in our society, but like, if someone were just gay, like...
You're never just gay.
Right, right. I mean, the idea is, what's specific about either the collective's negative, like their critiques, or their positive goals, their ideas about what it would look like to emphasize difference. What about that is specifically, like, gay? Yeah.
Right. I'll answer your question, and I'll refuse to answer it at the same time. Maybe ask yourself what isn't queer about all these other things that you might not think are queer. And the other is what we're trying to do is find, it's sort of like using a queer lens to try to open up space to talk about social and economic justice through like a queer trans lens, because right, people say, oh, this isn't a queer thing. Mm-hmm. So we're actually trying to say, actually, no, it's like pretty queer. Because you know, queer people are people of color, are immigrants, are poor, are rural, are living in shitty conditions. So like all the people that don't have healthcare, etc. Like we are all those people. Like I think that sort of concept of like that's not queer reinforces this stereotype that the only things that are gay white male urban centrism. And I think our collective, specifically born out of non-urban roots, is trying to decenter that sort of stereotype that people have in their head that like gay things can only be this. Because I think the best way to do like really good social and economic justice work is broad-based coalition building, and you can't build broad-based coalitions when everyone thinks gay is Chelsea.
So there's a lot to not be excited about and a lot to critique, but I was wondering what gets you all hot and bothered? What are the radical and very specific queer visions that you have? And I don't want to hear, I don't want to hear, like, we want economic justice, because that means a lot of very different things to a lot of very different things, like, you know, people.
Yeah, and I think people's visions of that will and should look different based upon, you know, like what works in rural Maine doesn't work in New York City. We're really emphatically anti-capitalist, so our vision of the world doesn't include capitalism. And that maybe is hard for some people to swallow, but we don't envision a world that we actually want to live in with that kind of hierarchy. And that kind of monetizing and valuing people's lives with a dollar. I think a lot of us have different focus, like a primary focus in terms of like what we're working on right now that like creates material changes in people's lives. And I feel really like out of it, because I'm like temporarily living in a place that's not my home. And I don't think of it as my home, so it's a bit hard to be this random PhD student in a city that's not mine. But in terms of like where I come from and what's important to me is working on issues around rural poverty, particularly how they relate to queer people and migrant workers, who also some of them are queer, even though some people might not think migrant justice is a queer issue. So I think, again, it looks different for each person in the collective because we are kind of all spread out and doing different things and sort of have different positions. Like I'm a gay white dude, so Things are different for me than, say, Yasmin Nair, who's an immigrant person of color living in Chicago. So things are going to look different in terms of what priorities are and what people think. But I think we like to keep it broad because there are so many different visions of what a possible livable future could be. But I think each of us would answer that question differently with really materially different answers, for sure. But what gets me excited and hot and bothered? That's a good question. I mean, I think some of it is like being able to, like, as part of this collective, I've been, like, I am the white middle class dude, so I'm the one that gets to do most of the traveling because I have the most privilege and access and background. So it's exciting for me to be able to, like, travel over the place and meet cool people and actually, like, learn about really rad projects happening in different places, different housing co-ops, people doing alternative healthcare projects. Like, I mean, I get to see a lot of really cool things, and hopefully I'll figure out a way to be able to share that knowledge with other people. That's what's exciting for me. And I get to meet, like, cute people, too. It's always nice. It's lonely in Maine. It's small.
That's an interesting point that you just brought up, that you're the one that gets to travel. In terms of the resources, isn't there a shared ability to share the resources, so that would be a shared privilege for everybody in the collective, and an important use of resources shared so that other voices and other people are presenting their...
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I mean, it's super complicated in terms of what that looks materially, because all the debt that we have, which is about $7,000, is all sitting on credit cards in my name and no one else's. So if we're talking about sharing our privilege, that's how I share mine, is to take on that responsibility because I have the family background to be able to get those kind of credit cards, and if shit goes down, I can ask someone for money, which other people can't. Other thing is, some people actually don't like being the public face. Which is the two folks in DC want nothing to do with the public side, and they do the website and editing. And then the other two folks do travel. One person doesn't travel, but they do events publicly, and the other person, Karma Chavez, who you heard, just recently joined the collective and is joining me in New York in September when we do a panel here. So things have been shifting with the collective, but materially what sharing privilege looks like happens in different ways, for sure. And we're actually, that little audio thing that we did was the first time we've tried figuring out how to hook other people into live events. And if we all knew how to use technology better, we maybe could have done something cooler, but we'll see what happens in the future. And I wasn't joking, it's really $7,000. So you should buy a book later.
Work with other organizations, because it seems like there's bigger issues at hand. So, like, to put the five of you in a bigger organization that's working for anti-war, do you do that?
Yeah, I mean, we sort of have, like, loose networks of friends. Like, at its core, like, Against Equality is, like, a bunch of friends that do something on the side and none of us get paid for it kind of thing, which I think is the best kind of... I think it's one of the best kinds of activism, because it's based on, like, a shared global affinity as opposed to, like, you know, staff salary or whatever. But that's also not people's realities. People need to be paid for the work, and it'd be great if we could all get paid for our work, but the reality is, like, we don't have an office, there's not a phone. You could try emailing us, but maybe someone will get back to you in a few weeks. Because, like, literally, we all have day jobs, and then we all do activism in our communities, and then we all do this extra thing on the side because we think it's important. I think once the third book comes out in October, the shift is going to be, okay, we publish all these books, let's stop publishing books, and think about how do we engage this archive in other ways, and does that mean some sort of working with other more established or nonprofit style organizations? That's a question. We'll have our 5-year visioning meeting maybe sometime in the future, but at the moment we're focused on, like, the small projects that we have, and then we'll see once the third book comes out, we'll give it a year, and then we have some ideas of the things that we want to do, but we haven't made any decisions yet, but hopefully we'll stop printing books if we've done that for a while.
When you talk about traveling, do you mean just in the U.S., or are you trying to go somewhere else, or maybe?
I mean, sometimes people email us and they're like, we'll pay you $5,000 to come to Australia, and we say, okay. But that doesn't happen very often. Like, it only happened once. And the person they wanted to travel couldn't travel, so we had to say no. But yeah, I mean, if you want us to come to your school or community group, you can contact us. I mean, this happened because Carlos and I have worked on projects in the past, and Carlos asked if I would do it, and I said yes. You know, like, it's as simple, like, it's really through, like, friendship networks that a lot of things happen, which maybe sounds like nepotism, but it's also, like, a way of, like, expressing friendship and collaborating. So maybe take, like, one or two more questions. I don't want to hold people captive.
I have a question, but I'd like to put it in context.
Sure.
I happen to be a culinary school graduate who now wants to study holistic healthcare, and some of my chef friends consider me a traitor to my culinary class because I'm advocating a plant-based diet as opposed to what I learned in culinary school. So the little bit that I've studied so far before I actually get into school has let me know, particularly in the area of AIDS, that nearly everything I thought was true about AIDS and disease in general is probably not only untrue, but pathologically a lie. And I'd like to know if the collective will be dealing with the issue of mainstream gay organizations dealing with AIDS and HIV, because the little bit that I've learned is telling me that not only what I learned is dangerous, but it could be dead wrong. HIV equals AIDS equals death may not be true. AIDS may not even exist. Dis-ease may not be what we think it is. Now, this is just a little bit that I've learned so far. If it turns out to be true, that means that the last 35 years of indoctrination is really just that. So I want to know the collective will be dealing with that in a progressive way, the way they dealt with now.
Sure. I mean, the collective doesn't, I mean, it's an interesting question. I feel I'm reacting really strongly to it internally, so I'm trying to figure out how to.
Take a deep breath.
I mean, in my academic life, I also teach about HIV and AIDS. Like, that's what I do for, that's how I make a living. So hearing your question, like, makes me think about a lot of things. I would say it's an interesting question because it positions, like, the healthcare and scientific community as a, like, so the archive is about the politics of inclusion, right? So military marriage and the prison industrial complex is this, these sites of inclusion. So for what I'm hearing is, like, okay, the scientific community or the healthcare industry is a site of inclusion.
The medical industrial complex.
There you go, medical industrial complex is a site of inclusion. So it would be interesting for us to delve into that. However, for me, on a personal level, I don't think I would take that leap. If other people are interested in, like, creating work about that, I think that's good. People should ask questions and do that. But on that particular topic, I'm not convinced by a lot of the work that's been produced around questioning the link between HIV and AIDS. So for me, on a personal level, I don't follow that line of thinking. I'm unconvinced, I guess is what I'll say. I'm unconvinced by the things that have been presented to me. I do think there are interesting questions that people have raised, but I'm not necessarily convinced that we should throw everything out or backtrack largely from what is sort of assumed to be medical truth at this moment. But I could be wrong. But I don't think it's necessarily a big focus of the collective at the current moment. And I don't think anyone has the... Yeah, there is an energy around focusing on that issue, but I mean, if people are doing that work and send it to us, then we would review it and see if it would fit into the archive. That's, like, we're not, I guess maybe to, like, backtrack again, we're not an organization. Like, we don't really have an office. Like, we are an archive. Like, the only things we publish are things that have already been printed on the internet. So, like, we don't produce work. We're an archive, and then we produce archival anthologies. So we're not producing new work. We don't have a budget to produce new work. That's who we are, so. I just want there to be clarity around, like, what our capabilities and limits are, and, like, our focus is pretty narrow. Like, we're an archive. That's what we do.
Maybe one more question if somebody has one.
Can you just say a couple of words about radical performativity that you have shown some kind of
animosity towards?
Yeah. Just what do you think its role in this entire, like, in the whole scheme?
Yeah, I mean, it's just when, I mean, I think there's a couple things in play, and maybe I haven't thought through it as well as I should have to make such strong comments, but Yeah, I think there's a performative politics that happens that's very superficial, and it becomes about performing a radical queer identity as opposed to like actually engaging in radical queer politics. And that it's a sort of question when aesthetics start to trump politics. And maybe that's a false dichotomy that I'm setting up, but I've been subject of attack from certain people that have, you know, made shit up about me on the internet and posted about how like I'm this poser radical queer academic or something. And so like I'm suspicious of groups of people that pose as like these radical queer anarchists, blah blah blah, who like don't actually do anything but start wars with people on the internet. And so that's sort of my, like I pull back from that sort of like aestheticization of like radical queer politics, because like that was me, and then it became this thing that like attacked me. So I'm much more interested in people that are like actually engaged in the day-to-day like political work that I do. Like people that are actually doing anti-poverty work instead of talking about how fucked up capitalism is. Like I actually want to be engaged with the people doing the actual work instead of the people that are aestheticizing and creating a soundtrack and a haircut for radical queer identity. I mean, and that's like sort of the intersections of like capitalism and radical queer politics creating this like really fucked up thing that like becomes like a consumer-based identity, even though you're not necessarily maybe consuming goods, but you're consuming really specific experiences. So that's sort of my like response to that kind of culture. And for folks that don't know, there's a group called Bashback that sort of started in the Chicago area that is sort of like the pinnacle of this, and they were like featured in Details magazine in the fashion section. So if that gives you any sense of like, there was this radical potential, but then it sort of like became this really horrendous thing. So, and I don't want to talk about them a lot because I don't want to give them more airtime.
Unless anyone is dying to say something.
Okay.
Thank you, Ryan.
I would like to invite you to come back and actually engage with the videos, which are about 40 minutes each. And also, there will be several other events happening in the near future. On July 12th, we'll have Jared Gilbert, who is a graduate of the Yale University Divinity School, and he will be talking about queer and feminist theologies and the work that he is doing in founding a new church in Brooklyn that will include queer people. And then on July 21st, there will be a workshop with Queerocracy on AIDS activism today, strategies and tactics, and they are recruiting to bring people on a big bus that will be going to the demonstration in Washington, D.C. on July 24th. And then there will be also a queer screening of queer film organized by Chicago-based artist Fred Moffitt sometime in August. So please go to the website and keep on coming. It's great to see you here. Thank you.